Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Business news, views, and insights from across the globe.
Welcome, everyone, to Hidden Growth Champions, our podcast series. Now in its third season, we've got a wonderful array of speakers, thought leaders, executives, practitioners who are bringing a new lens to how we envision the future, how we craft new ambitions, creative strategies, and bring them to life. Today in our virtual studio, I've got Christian Stadler. Christian, thank you for coming onto our studio. It's great to have you with us. And please tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Hi, Sar. You know, thank you very much for having me today. And I'm particularly pleased to join you from Africa myself, Nairobi to be more specific. So at least we're on the same continent today.
Wonderful.
Background, briefly for me, I'm a professor of strategic management at the University of Warwick in the United Kingdom. So I'm interested in all things strategy, really. And more recently, I've written a book on how companies can include a much larger group of people into the strategy making process, something I think we'll talk more about today.
100%. Christian, I'm very conscious that words have meaning, and powerful words like strategy have even more. So when we think about the words open strategy, to many people, it feels counterintuitive. I suspect how people felt about Agile 20 or 25 years ago when the Agile Manifesto was written. I suspect when people spoke about beyond budgeting about a decade ago, started speaking about that, it's emotive, right? You often have a reaction to it. So when people think about strategy, open probably wouldn't be the first words that come to mind. So for members of our audience who hear the term for the first time, or may have heard it before, but I'm not really sure what it means or how it's different, perhaps tell us a little bit more about what open strategy really is.
And admittedly, my first reaction was the same as most people would have. A few years ago, a small consulting firm in Germany, IMP, approached me and said, you know, we're doing these things where we involve a much larger group of people into the strategy making process. We even involve people from outside organizations that we support in order to come up with good strategies for our clients. And I thought, you know, that's a bit weird. That's impossible. You know, strategy is for the top leadership, maybe a few selected supporters and advisors, but there's lots of secrecy around it. It's the kind of core plan. Nonetheless, because it was weird, I was interested. So, you know, I decided to join some of the workshops they were running and, you know, noticed how they do these things in a very sort of crafted, careful manner that it doesn't undermine those things that you might want to keep secret. And then I started to, you know, interview some of their clients, interview them. I was joined by three co-authors, two other professors, and the managing partner from that firm to start writing a book, yeah, where we then interviewed companies across the world who had done this sort of thing. So in a nutshell, you know, open strategy means that you don't just have this small selected group of senior executives, but you include a much larger group of people into the process. And if it's well-designed, if it's carefully thought through, it has tremendous power.
Now, Christian, when I think about our own work involving people in the strategy process, often, or the first groups we often think about is within the organization, the extended leadership team. We may have high potentials in the business who've been identified, who we see as more innovative, who we see work on interesting projects, who perhaps are closer to the edges of the organization, and therefore internally they could add a lot of information. But open strategy has also grown to include groups outside of the organization. So perhaps let's talk about those in turn. Let's talk about those inside the organizations. How does one go about identifying and then engaging people who perhaps are closer to the edges, who perhaps seen by top leadership in the organization as ones that should naturally be part of the strategy process? Talk to us a little bit about that process.
Often it develops quite organically. I give you an example. Saxonia Systems is a small software house that is based in Dresden, that's in the eastern part of Germany. And around the financial crisis, they were running into massive problems. They were sort of a little bit of, we do everything you need in software support type house. And that was fine, you know, up until this point. But then in the financial crisis, particularly the larger clients started to cut their budgets. One of the biggest and most important clients they had went bust. And, you know, the fire was kind of already on the roof. They really noticed it's getting tight. So the founders spurted away and extended leadership team to think about what can we do? How can we save our company? And they came up sort of, you know, with some smart and immediate actions, consolidate customer accounts, coordinate a little bit better. That saved the company. And then they got thinking, hey, this was actually really, you know, fruitful to have a slightly larger group of people involved. And they started to install more regular meetings of this extended leadership team. Now, this is a software house. And in the software houses, people are used to be involved in, you know, very iterative type processes in the creation of software. And it's not a particularly large organization. They had just 100 plus people. So those who were not part of this leadership team were raising their hand and were saying, hey, what's going on there? You know, why are not we having a say in this either? You should be involved. And, you know, to the credit of those running the company, they thought, well, you know, let's give it a shot. And they set up what they call little sort of strategy spurts that happen every few weeks, where everyone who wants to be involved can actually be involved in the discussions around where should we move strategically as an organization. On average, about a quarter of all members of the organization join in these discussions. You know, they're varying on what sort of topic is on the agenda. And the company has grown massively since, so, you know, far beyond just saving themselves. More recently, they've been acquired by a larger company in Germany precisely because of, you know, this ability of them to create value beyond the usual. So as I said, you know, things can grow organically sometimes. Now, it doesn't have to be like this. It can also be deliberate. And if you as a sort of leadership team think, you know, how can we do this? My advice would be look at, you know, where do you have an area that might face disruption, and it's not my core business, because you know you don't necessarily want to experiment straight away with a new strategy making approach in your core business. Do that. If it works well, then you know you spread it further. Dr. Oetker did that. It's a large consumer foods business, and they experimented first with cereals, breakfast cereals, which is one of the smaller units they have. And after they saw this is working really well, they expanded it to pizza, frozen pizza, which is their biggest core business.
It really comes to mind for me that sometimes we may be working in open strategy, but not call it strategy, right? Sometimes the word strategy itself kind of conjures up the wrong images, but we might be talking about the direction of the business. We might be talking about disruption, and people in the business might have a lot to contribute to it. Sometimes we'll speak about goals and aspirations and ambitions. Sometimes we'll talk about problem solving, right? So it kind of brings to my mind of whether or to what degree the questions we ask are the ones that bring audiences into the strategy conversation. They participate in open strategy, not because that's the label or that's, you know, that's what we decide to call the process. That may be useful in itself, but really because the questions are interesting and they get curious and they feel that they've got something to contribute. What are your thoughts around that?
So first of all, I absolutely agree. I have basically a bit of a fluid picture around strategy is not just what the CEO does. And that's sometimes, you know, what people think is strategy. Strategy is finding solutions, creating plans for issues that an organization faces. And that can be in various domains. Yeah, sort of the corporate strategy exercise that might happen sort of once a year in many organizations, even though I would argue that's not necessarily the smartest way to do things anyway, with, you know, the world being so fluid, you probably have to more often and more frequently visit big questions, which smart organizations do. Telefonica has this sort of, you know, system where every day thousands of people discuss aspects that target, that affect the strategy of the organization. So it doesn't need to be just an annual planning exercise there. And, you know, if you have this sort of broader definition of strategy, then the idea that you include people that are not usually part of that strategy making process is one that is applicable across very many domains and different hierarchy levels of the organization. In other words, you know, it's useful for everyone.
You know, it reminds me, one of the CEOs that we've been working with recently said it so nicely when he spoke about the shift that happens in the energy in the room when people are engaged in opening up the strategy process, when they're invited, not because of their title or their status or even their experience in the organization, but because they respond to questions and they show commitment and interest and motivation in solving interesting problems. So the way he looked at it was, or I guess the yardstick he used to see whether this was a useful process, was, you know, way before we got to externally testing the strategy, was, does it lift the energy in the room? Does it make people feel that they are participating in something significant? You know, is there discretionary effort that people are all willing to plow in? So yeah, just as you were speaking, it just comes to mind.
Absolutely. You know, the smart CEO, by the way, whoever it is, when people get involved, they develop psychological ownership of an idea and they feel that they're part of it. It's not then the usual sort of, okay, ideas come from the top and I wonder, what does it mean for me? How can I do that? Ah, well, you know, actually, I can just continue how I have done things. I'll sit this one out. That's not the case if you actually develop a stake in something new because you had participation in it. I give you a quick example where I thought it's really strongly worked. Barclays UK Retail in 2012 got a new CEO, Ashok Vaswani, and he knew that the world is going to go more digital. And he could have sort of, you know, just hired a consulting company, maybe, you know, worked it out with his leadership team. But he decided to involve everyone of the people working in retail in Barclays, and that's 30,000 people. He did that through sort of, you know, a smart strategy TAM tool that IBM had developed. And by people being able in a, it's a sort of conference type setting that lasts 3 days, to get involved in this, they got excited about this stuff. You know, they felt, you know, I can figure out what it means for me. I have a stake in this. Digitalization is not just something that is going to take away my job. It's in fact something that I can integrate in the things I do, can make me better in my job. I talked to a number of people in Barclays Retail, and, you know, they said the energy they had around the strategy topic when they did this, it was unmatched. They, you know, made this switch into digital in a mind-blowing way. Shortly after the jam, they introduced their first mobile app and quickly got 1 million users. Today, with 9 million users, it's one of the most successful fintech products in the United Kingdom, which is remarkable when you consider we're talking about a more than 300-year-old legacy bank who is now a real digital player.
Yes. You know, Christian, as you're speaking, it brings to mind for me how opening up the strategy process internally might organically lead to its opening externally. You know, if I think of Barclays, you know, I certainly think of how they've not just defended, but grown their youth base, how they revitalized their consumer banking division. But more than that, I think about things like partnerships and collaborations with others. I think about Rise and that entire environment where startups and non-traditional players could partner with them. I think about the API exchange, for example, that opened the door for much broader collaboration, in which what you've described has, you know, has played a very important role in. So perhaps tell us a little bit about what happens when strategy open outwards, when that kind of unleashing of energy and the kind of tools and you know, approaches that you've been describing start to involve people on the outside.
So some of it happens, I think, in that manner, which is rather sort of organically natural, the way you describe it, as more and more companies realize that they operate in wider ecosystems, and without involving the partner organizations in that ecosystem in making big decisions, whatever they decide on their own is pretty unlikely to succeed. So that's one aspect or one way to think about it. An alternative way that this can also happen is that it is deliberately. Now think of, you know, a situation where you as an organization might face disruption. And if that's the case, then probably just involving those who are already part of your more immediate network is not sufficient to prepare yourself for potential disruption, because all of them in a way are, you know, thinking still somewhat similar and in the same sort of world view as you do, as you work in the same mold. What you want really is you want to have people involved who come from entirely different setting, think entirely differently, might have faced, you know, challenges of your kind, but in very different industry type settings. And you can do that, for example, in a workshop type setup where you involve, my suggestion would be half of the participants in that workshop would be from inside your organization and half of them are from outside. And as I said, from settings, from places that give them very, very different views and experiences that you have. And once you set up this workshop, you can give them a task to create a nightmare competitor. What I mean by that is you set up groups, always mixed of them with half internal, half external, who come up with ideas. And if these ideas would materialize, they don't exist yet, yeah, but would they materialize and somebody would create an organization around these ideas, they would really hurt you. You know, they kind of, you know, pull the carpet under your feet. So, you know, that gives you a mandate to think a bit crazy and a bit differently. And as you develop that, and, you know, you can do it in a sort of gamified way where the teams present and you take votes, a bit like Dragon Den style, as we call it in the UK, or Shark Tank in the US. I'm not sure what you call it in South Africa. Do you have that kind of format as well?
Yeah, no, absolutely. We every day we're listeners and watchers of these shows, absolutely.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, you set it up a little bit like that, yeah? And this way you can kind of, you know, start to think about things that could be really hurtful if they would happen. And then you use it either as a reflection point, so, you know, see whether your strategy is solid if things like this would happen, or you might use it as an inspiration and create new businesses.
Mm. Now, for those in our audiences listening, you know, many of whom are heads of strategy, are, you know, advisors to the CEO, sometimes the CEOs themselves, heads of transformation. Very often, one of the thoughts that does come up is, how do I get my fellow executives on board? What happens with the cynics? What happens with those who may not see the full extent of disruption, or may feel that their current strategy process still works? It's not completely broken. What are the kind of arguments you would pose to those?
So, you know, there's a few things that come to mind. Now, first of all, the executive who is in charge of that, the CEO typically, he or she really needs to be a believer in this. If she's not, then I think the whole exercise will fail. But let's assume she is and sort of, you know, wants to give this a try and thinks that, you know, involving bigger amount of people is sensible. But there's cynics, as you point out. Now, what this executive could do is rally a few of those who are fully on board around a specific problem, idea, challenge, and get them to work now in this open manner. And I am positive that, you know, the results will speak for themselves. And we always have that. Yeah, if results are good, more and more people start to come on board. We also develop a little self-assessment tool. And if you go to our website, openstrategy.info, it's right there, where you can answer just 6 questions. And based on whatever your answers are, we will tell you whether you're ready. And if you're not ready, we have a sort of few suggestions how you can personally become more open and sort of more ready for more open things. These are, you know, ideas like spend more time with the frontline, where, you know, people think differently and you get sort of, you know, fresher view. Organized dinner parties where you involve and invite people with very different backgrounds. This comes from the 19th century saloon idea that was very popular in Vienna. We are Austrians, so, you know, we had to bring a bit from our own country into the book as well, where philosophers, mathematicians, industrialists all come together for these evening debates and sort of, you know, start to get inspiring ideas because you have this cross-fertilization. Creativity often comes about through recombination of things that you didn't think of recombining before. That's why this is fruitful. And the last thing, you know, I suggest is spend a considerable amount of time reading. You might say, well, you know, this guy is a professor. Of course, he's going to say you read. But this is something that smart executives do as well. If you watch this Netflix series Inside Bill's Brain, which is about Bill Gates, you will have realized that he constantly carries around this massive canvas bag full of books, and he spends hours of reading every week. And, you know, executives are busy, but if Bill Gates finds the time, if Oprah Winfrey finds the time, if Elon Musk finds the time to spend a few hours reading every week, then, hey, you know, I'm guessing, you know, all the executives listening today will find that time as well if they really want to.
Christian, let's talk a little bit about an aspect of open strategy, which is not only about the strategy making, but strategy doing, the actual execution of it. It really strikes me, and from our work as well, is that opening up the strategy process isn't just good for thinking about strategy. It's also good for doing. It's also good for piloting and experimenting and then taking some of the concepts in our strategy and testing them with partners, with customers. Talk us about perhaps an example or two of how that's happened in your world.
Sure. So, you know, the catchphrase I would use here is go slow in order to go fast. Typically, the development of a strategy is relatively fast, but then it's, you know, agonizing, difficult, failing when you try to execute and introduce this strategy. By involving people, and here I'm talking primarily about people from inside the organization, they, as we mentioned earlier, they kind of get excited, you know, and it might take longer to develop the strategy this way, but they become natural champions of new ideas by doing so. And I give you an example, which is a little bit outside the business world, as it has been a particularly intriguing one that I came across. When you go to Borneo, then, you know, one of the big problems, as in many areas with rainforest, is illegal logging. And there was an American lady who was visiting as a student and noticed that and sort of always thought about, I want to go back and start something to fight this. And, you know, the typical way of doing that is come up with some smart ideas and then introduce them. But as she, to her credit, noticed, is in the end, it hinges on locals really buying into this idea. So she engaged in a process that she called radical listening. And they interviewed about 400 people in one particular national park where illegal logging was a massive problem. And what she found out through that process, people told her, well, you know, we cut down trees because this is the only way for us to get big amounts of money in a short time period that we need when there's a medical incident in the family. And that's the only way for us to do that. With that in mind, you know, with this insight, she then started to develop a solution that was geared exactly towards this particular issue. And the locals, having been part of the thinking through, became involved in that, became champions of this. The solution was, in fact, you know, pretty simple once this was understood what the problem was. In communities where there was no illegal logging, there was a 70% discount on medical treatment. And people could also pay in kind, meaning, you know, they could bring in manure in order to do that. They could provide some of their time working in an organic farming project, which was the second aspect of this whole initiative, because people then learned how to make a living through organic farming and step away from the slash and burn technique. So cut down trees and, you know, just grow things until the land is no longer fertile. And, you know, this would have not happened if people would have not been involved in the development of the idea, because they would have not come up with an idea that works there, and neither would the locals have felt, you know, this is something that we own, something that we really came up ourselves. That, I think, summarizes that power that you can get on the implementation side if people are involved in the development side.
100%. Let's turn the page for a moment into some specific applications of open strategy. And the one that I'm thinking about for a moment is when we think about disruption, one of the forms of response to it is not only through partnerships for capability, but also a particular type of it, which is around competition, which is partnering directly with your competitors. And that brings open strategy onto a different level, right? So tell us a little about how does the practice of open strategy can help what seems to be at the outset is direct competitors to cooperate and in fact to compete better against a wave of disruption. Any thoughts around that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, usually we are worried about telling our competitors too much because we think they're going to eat our lunch. And the nice thing is when I involve them, then I do that usually at a stage where I sort of thought things through to some extent already, and I'm ahead of the curve, which is really important when disruption happens anyway. So, you know, that process, for example, I described earlier, that nightmare competitor exercise, is one which lends itself perfectly to involving some competitors. And this has been done by the German group I referred to earlier, where for one of their clients, they involved competitors. And the competitor, sure, you know, knew what the outcome was, but the difference between them and their competitors was that they have, had involved internal and external people, and the internal started to already think about how we can actually move in this direction, and, you know, were then faster than anybody else could potentially be in really turning this around. In other words, you know, if you smartly design it, not much of a problem to involve competitors. The second thought I have on this is we overrate competition and underrate cooperation, I think, in many instances, where particularly as you note yourself, when there's disruption, it needs changes that are so substantial that usually an organization can't do it alone. And, you know, having a few of your competitors to move in the same direction will create an overall shift in your industry that is beneficial for you as well. So, you know, don't be too worried about it, would be my response.
No, 100%. Christian, perhaps one last question. I know we're getting towards the end of our conversation. When I think about the kind of challenges, societal challenges, national challenges that we see, and particularly in emerging markets, I know we're both speaking this morning from two different parts of the African continent, but certainly not only limited to it, in many emerging markets around the world. It strikes me, and also kind of referring to one of the earlier examples you've cited, that open strategy could be really valuable in solving bigger problems, in solving problems that the organization on its own probably couldn't solve and would certainly not orient its business strategy towards. And that brings with it a whole raft of opportunities of how the organization can engage non-traditional partners, governments, social organizations, technology players, etc., etc. So for me, one of the most exciting parts about open strategy is that ability to play in not only technologically emerging spaces, but socially emerging spaces, in places where regulation may not be all in place, where the regulators themselves are still trying to figure out how we bring order and stability into the system. And emerging markets are just a wonderful landscape to practice that. So your thoughts, to what degree have you come across the practice of open strategy in emerging markets?
Less so, to be honest. And I think less so, partly because people are very worried about somebody stealing their idea, which has to do with some of the institutional voids where, you know, people always think that I can't protect my ideas. I don't think, you know, they're right in their thinking, because even when I talk to entrepreneurs, to business people out here in Kenya, where I am at the moment, whether you succeed or not, it's not really I have the smartest idea. It's about making it happen. And making it happen depends on, you know, bringing others on board. It does, of course, depend also on my ability to raise capital, which can often be challenging. But the power of getting others on board and excited and creating a bit of a better and bigger ecosystem around an idea will help you to overcome this issue. So I think, you know, emerging markets are ripe for doing some of that. And because, as I noticed, you know, people are worried, you can start by doing it internally, by maybe involving a few very trusted partners. I've done something like this here with a media company in Kenya, and I think they found it really useful as an exercise where they didn't go as crazy as, you know, involving competitors, but they did involve people from their wider ecosystem, people they knew, and developed some fresh ideas and thoughts that would have probably not been so obvious had they just done it internally.
And Christian, perhaps just a last question, and that is, you know, when we work in environments where there are non-traditional players, when we work in environments that are being disrupted, we find an extraordinary number of young individuals. And what I mean by young is not just young at age, but young at heart, you know, from the 50s and 60s year old who are kind of looking at their own industry and deciding to disrupt it themselves with a wealth of experience, to those in their 20s, looking from the outside and saying it should have been this way in the first place. So
you mean you and me, by young at heart, I'm guessing.
Exactly. Any final thoughts or insights for them?
I would say, you know, many of them naturally reach out to a wider and diverse group of people out of necessity. They don't have the sort of resources and organization that large companies can rely on. So they have to do it. And they benefit from that. They get this sort of, you know, different perspective. So I would just say, you know, do what you do naturally and, you know, don't be afraid that this is a problem. It's in fact a massive benefit by getting to know many people, building your networks this way, bringing thoughts, ideas into your own small sort of startup setting that you wouldn't get otherwise. You know, again, don't be worried about ideas being stolen. There's a million people who have the same core idea that you have as well, but there's very, very few who can pull it off. And the ones who can pull it off is those who have all those little bits and pieces in place. That's where you need others to help you.
Christian, it's been wonderful having you at our virtual studio this morning. It's been great speaking to you. It's such an exciting topic. It's so nice to see open strategy being tested and piloted and used in so many different contexts, and great talking to you from the other side of the African continent.
Massive pleasure. You know, thank you very much. As I just today released a full sort of teaching package online, I wanted to alert listeners to that as well. Some of you might, you know, be engaged in more sort of teaching that type of subject. So again, openstrategy.info, you get everything for free to download and you can go out and teach Open Strategy yourself.
Fantastic. Thank you again, and we'll speak soon.
Thank you.
Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Join us next time for more business news, views, and insights from across the globe.